for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Today, we're talking about the realities of unforgivable curses, Hermione's new spew endeavor, and we take a look at what we can learn about Beauxbatons and Durmstrang. Welcome, everybody, to episode 34 of First Years. Today, we're going over chapters 14 and 15 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And we have a lot to go over. But I want to start out with talking about teachers, two specifically, Severus Snape and Mad-Eye Moody. So we find out in these chapters that Snape makes Neville disembowel toads when he has one as a pet, which is just an entirely new level of cruel. We see some pretty crazy things from teachers in these chapters. Snape having a vindictive punishment for Neville. Do we think that's as bad as using transfiguration as a punishment? Because this seems to me like a much more personal punishment than the one Moody gave to Malfoy. But then we have Moody in class showing off these disturbing spells in front of the students, some of which are personal, like to Harry seeing the killing curse for the first time in his life. So there seems to be some rules that teachers have to follow here, but what are they exactly? Like, why is transfiguring Draco Malfoy into a ferret not okay, but Snape having Neville disembowel toads okay? Does anyone know? Where's the line? Why doesn't anybody report this? Because we've seen some horrible behavior from Snape, and he just seems to get away with it. Why doesn't anyone go to Dumbledore? Or is it just because even if they did, probably nothing would happen? But we also see here that, like a lot of the other students, Snape seems to be a little wary of Moody. And I mean, who wouldn't be? But this is Snape, who's been like our secondary villain in these books so far where Harry is concerned. So why would Snape of all people fear Moody? And do we think it's actually just because he hasn't been allowed to teach Defense Against the Dark Arts? Or is it something else? Either way, I feel like that shouldn't be a motive for him to take anything out on a student like they speculate about, that this punishment for Neville was so cruel because Snape is just in a bad mood all the time because of Moody. So in these chapters, we get two lessons from Moody. And in the first one, we hear from Professor Lupin, who has kindly written a note describing all of the creatures they've gone over so far. And Moody says, "Okay, but you're behind on dealing with curses." This lesson is a practical one. So we got that right in our last episode where we figured Moody wasn't going to be a by-the-book person, both literally and figuratively. But what stood out to me here about that is the list of the things they went over last year was mostly creatures. Now Moody is going to teach them curses. So they're no longer learning to defend themselves from creatures, but from other people, who may be the biggest threat of all. Humans do tend to wreak the most havoc on both other creatures and each other. And I think that goes along with how we grow with Harry in each book. They've been learning about the magical world and all these creatures that are in it. And yeah, that's necessary information, but how often are you going to find yourself in a bog and need to protect yourself from a hinky punk? The real threat is much more close to home. This is the darker side of the wizarding world and wizardry. We speculated way back in book one about whether or not owls signified that wizards were good, or if they were bad, or if they were both. This class gives us a real answer to that. There are curses out there that can harm other people, take away their will, and kill them. They've been deemed unforgivable and lands you a sentence in Azkaban for life. So people must have used them before. And for the curses to be called unforgivable, we get a sense of the morality or the standards of the wizarding world, that they believe that none of these are okay to do to another person. What do you think that says about the wizarding world as a whole? That these spells exist and there are punishments attached to them. And going along with that, these curses aren't supposed to be shown to children that are under 16, yet Moody insists on demonstrating them and practicing them on the students. He says that Dumbledore wants them to know. Do we believe him on this? Or do we think he's making it up just so he can teach in his own way? Do you think Moody would even care enough to make up a lie about why he's doing this? I think he has a good point that they need to see what would be coming at them, not just theoretically, but what's the rush? Is it because he's only here for 1 year? If he's telling the truth about Dumbledore wanting them to know these spells so they can protect themselves, why now? We do find out later in this chapter, when we hear from Sirius that he's coming back, that something is up. That because Dumbledore took Moody out of retirement, it means that he's reading the signs. And Sirius says that there are rumors about that he's heard. So if something is going on, and Dumbledore took Moody out of retirement in order to, I don't know, keep things safe or have him keep an eye on things, why is he only going to be here for a year? You would think that he would want him there on a much longer term. And in the following chapter, Moody performs the Imperius Curse on the students, citing that Dumbledore wants them to know what it feels like. We've met Dumbledore several times throughout these books, but we don't really get as much interaction with him as we do with Snape or McGonagall. He's still this kind of mysterious figure to us. Do we think he actually wanted this? Is this how he would teach this lesson? What I do love about this scene is that we get to hear from other characters. Normally, Hermione is the one that has all of the answers in every class, but we actually get to hear from Ron and Neville, which I think is a really nice change. And perhaps this is because these spells are more widely known by the families who lived through the war when Voldemort was in power, back when Harry was a baby. So that information was probably talked about or known about in those families. But it was nice to hear Ron answer a question and Neville answer a question. And we get information not just about these spells, but their connection to evil work. A lot of people were controlled by the Imperius Curse back in the day. It was difficult for the Ministry to sort out who was actually being controlled and who was lying about being controlled. How do you think they figure that out? Moody also says that the Cruciatus Curse was popular back in the day, and I can't even imagine what Voldemort and others would be using it for. It's horrible to think about. And when Hermione gives the last answer about Avada Kedavra, several people look uneasy. And I wonder if just the sound of the spell puts people on edge, just like seeing the dark mark or hearing Voldemort's name. And what caught my eye is that Avada Kedavra is the only one that doesn't have another name. We have the Cruciatus Curse and the Imperius Curse, which are different names than the actual incantation, which is Crucio and Imperio. Avada Kedavra is just it. That's what it is. And I wonder if that's why people are uneasy hearing it, because the name of it is the same as the incantation. Moody says that it's the worst spell. I want to know if you guys agree. Is dying worse than having your free will taken away? Or being tortured? Or is it the worst because you can survive the other two and you can't survive the killing curse. He says it can't be blocked, so you have no way to defend yourself from it besides getting out of the way. What makes this such a momentous moment is that we finally learn exactly what happened to Harry's parents. Since book one, Harry's memories of his parents have only been that of a bright flash of green light. And now we know exactly where that comes from. This was the curse that was used on them. And Harry's really affected by this. How could he not be? And so is Neville. They're both very shaken up by this lesson. Neville's disturbed by the Cruciatus curse, and Harry with Avada Kedavra. And what's so crazy here is that a lot of the other students just don't get it. It's kind of like Moody's message just goes right over their heads. He's talking about what it's like in the real world of the wizarding world, and what they need to be prepared for, based on how things used to be during the height of Voldemort. But they end up leaving class thinking everything was so cool and not really realizing the gravity of the situation and those curses. It reminds me of this one episode of Band of Brothers, which is a wonderful miniseries from HBO if you haven't seen it, where some of the replacements show up and they're eager to get in the fight and are like bored with the quieter part of war and they want to see some action and they're asking when they'll see some action because they haven't experienced how terrible and bloody it is when you do have to fight. And there's this scene where one of the more experienced men has to be like, shut the fuck up. This is the best part of war I've ever seen. I have hot food and hot showers and I don't have grenades going off and guns shooting at me all the time. And it's this really heartbreaking scene because this new guy gets his feelings hurt. But the more experienced soldier is absolutely right. You can't romanticize these things because they're real and they're horrible. Things were horrible during Voldemort's time. These spells aren't theoretical. They were used on people. And would any of these students be prepared to face this back then if they were alive? Probably not. Would they respect what Moody's saying more? And would it have more weight if they had experienced that tough time? Something tells me yes. But at the same time, these kids are 14. They've grown up in a world without Voldemort for the most part. They're lucky that they haven't been in this situation in which they know the real life gravity of this kind of situation. They're lucky that the wizarding world is peaceful and so they can treat it just like a class. But it's interesting that they kind of miss the point of the whole lesson. Except for Neville, really, who is just as affected by the lesson as Harry is. And I think we see a softer side of Moody here after class, who can be a tough-ass teacher, but knows when to take care of his students. And it seems that he's done that with Neville. You know, he made him a cup of tea and gave him a book on plants that he thought he would like. It's a really sweet personal touch. Moody seems to care about knowing each of the students. We see that when he's taking attendance and he makes sure to look at each of them in turn when he calls their name. It's the complete opposite of what Snape does with the knowledge about his students. In the following class, when Harry is put under the Imperius curse, he's the only one who manages to shake it off. He describes it as this really happy feeling where you'd go along with anything and you're content to do whatever this person tells you to do, which is just really freaky and uncomfortable for me to read that that's how the spell operates. But that's the whole point, and that's why it's unforgivable. But Harry is able to break free. And it starts off with questioning the order. And he's able to like only half jump and half stay still and he falls over. But why do we think that Harry is the only one that's able to break free? Besides the fact that he's the main character. I wonder if it comes from him being the person that will challenge the status quo when he sees injustice. You know, Harry doesn't stand idly by. We've seen that in the first three books. He'll ignore the orders to stay in the common room when Ginny is down in the Chamber of Secrets. He'll go into the forest, if that means finding out answers. He'll go to save the Sorcerer's Stone when everyone assures him it's perfectly safe. It's who he is. And I feel like standing up to authority and bringing about change for something that isn't right first starts off with questioning the situation and asking why. But it's also interesting that it's Harry who's able to break free, not Hermione. Like I said before, we usually see her excel in these classes, or all classes in general, but not this time. It's Harry's determination. What do you think the difference is between Harry and Hermione in this instance? Or what qualities do you think help Harry with this and not Hermione? After this class, Harry and Ron are talking about how Moody's paranoid and that it's like he thinks that they're going to be attacked at any minute. So is everything from the previous class wearing off and they're just not getting it now? Or are they right? Is Moody being paranoid? I mean, they are in a school, so they're probably not going to get attacked while they're here. But we just spoke about what actually happens out in the wizarding world. But remember what we know about Moody. He's paranoid because he's been so good at his job and got so many people locked up in Azkaban. So he has a lot of enemies. Remember what our guest said last episode, that maybe he created this magical eye because someone got the advantage on him and he never wants to be caught off guard ever again. So perhaps that's why he's pushing so hard, because he knows what it's like to be caught off guard. But speaking of Hermione, she has a new goal in these chapters. So she's been running off to the library pretty much every second that she has free, and we finally learn why. So she comes into the common room. Harry and Ron are doing their divination homework, and Ron uses the phrase, "We've been working like house elves here," which implies that house elves are worked incredibly hard and that he and Harry should be given credit for doing such hard work as their divination homework that they're making up. So she's been researching and she created SPEW, or SPEW, the Society for the Promotion of Elfish Welfare. She made buttons, she's recruiting Harry and Ron, without asking them, I might add, and has their first meeting in the common room. And we learn that house elves were enslaved centuries ago, and she can't believe that no one has done anything about it. But Ron insists that they're happy, and she wants them to get paid and have them have safe places to work and pensions and vacations. And Harry and Ron just kind of look at her like she's crazy. Even Fred and George say that they've visited the kitchens before, and the elves are happy that they think they have the best job in the world. And Hermione says it's because they're, quote, uneducated and brainwashed, unquote. And it makes me wonder what these elves were doing before they were enslaved by wizards. But what do we think about Hermione's actions here? What do we think about her calling them uneducated and brainwashed? Because that line did stick out to me when I read it. Is she right? Or is this not her place to act? Based on what we know about house elves, which we've seen two so far, how do you think they would feel about Hermione's plan to fight for their freedom and their pay? What do you think? Hermione does make a great point here when it comes to Hogwarts' history and calling it a revised history since it doesn't mention house elves. This is something that is definitely true in our world as well, where history is told by people who skip over things or don't make things sound as bad as they actually were. So we need to be very careful with what we read because entire things in history could just be skipped over. But regardless of whether you think Hermione is right or not, if I can use my usual phrase here, it's interesting here that we see how people react to her plans. Some people just aren't listening, others are donating to shut her up, and others are interested but really don't want to take a public stance on it. And I think we see that a lot when it comes to things that go against the status quo, where some people just don't want to be involved because it isn't the popular thing to do, and others want to support it but don't want to wear the badge and publicly attach themselves to it because they don't want to stand out. Where do you stand on that? Would you join Hermione in her endeavor or not? And speaking of Fred and George, they seem to be up to something. I don't know if you guys caught this or not, but they've been in the corner talking amongst themselves, writing a letter. And okay, Fred and George being up to something probably shouldn't be a surprise. But what do you think they're up to? We see them on separate occasions talking to each other, writing something down. When we see them in the Great Hall, they're discussing, quote, "If he won't talk to us in person, we'll have to send him the letter after all." What do you think is going on here? Now we're going to get into the deep divey stuff, my favorite part. I feel like it's been a while since we've had a chance to really dive deep into something. So we're going to talk about Hedwig. So she has been carrying letters back and forth between Harry and Sirius. She's barely home for a full night, and Harry sends her back out again. My question is, how do birds find their way? Especially someone like Sirius, where she has no idea where he might be. Do they use magic? Or what's going on with that? I was just learning recently about how birds migrate, and I'd love to share that with you to see if we can get an answer here. So, not all birds migrate, and those that do, the distance they travel will vary. You know, for example, some just need to go to a different elevation, which might just be like a different location on the same mountain. Others might just travel the distance of a couple of states, while others will travel from Canada to Mexico. The reason they do this is because the resources get low in one area during the winter, so they move south to another area that has plenty of resources until the spring. We don't know exactly how birds know where to go when they're migrating, but evidence points to that they get a sense of their direction from the sun, the stars, and the geomagnetic field of the Earth. So do we think something similar to that occurs when Hedwig is finding Sirius? Do these owls get like a magnetic sense from people that they need to deliver to? Do all of the owls have this? Or is this something that they pick up on while they're in the magical world? Because it's not like they're learning to go from like a single point A to a single point B. Sirius moves around. When we get his letter back, he's already back up north. So how did Hedwig find him? Also, when Sirius says that Harry should start using other owls to write to him because Hedwig stands out, Hermione says that they're not native to the area. So I looked into it. Snowy owls live in northern regions, usually near the North Pole. They usually like to hang out in the Arctic tundra. But during non-breeding seasons, they'll travel south, so they end up in southern Canada or northern parts of the US, Asia, and Europe. Sometimes they'll need to travel longer distances to find food. When their prey sources get really low, they'll have to travel farther and farther to find prey. But when their prey is plentiful, they may not need to travel, and they can have plenty of successful breeding seasons. When they do need to travel farther south to find food, they've been known to go as far as Texas and Oklahoma, and it's actually been recorded that one even found its way to Hawaii. And here's something really cool that I found out recently. You normally see dark markings on snowy owls. Both male and female snowy owls have this, but males tend to have fewer, and they'll actually lose them as they age. So normally you can identify a female snowy owl as the one with more markings on her than the males who have fewer and may be totally white. In these chapters, we learn more about the Triwizard Tournament. We learn that all three heads of the schools are always on the panel because they all got injured in 1792 when a cockatrice went on a rampage. I'm confused as to why that would be the reason they would get to judge, because I'm also assuming that those were the headmasters at the time, and that Dumbledore and the others were not alive back then. So we have another example of tradition being followed, even though I'm not really sure it makes a lot of sense. But not only that, I feel like this information doesn't bode well for what's to come. They initially canceled the tournament because too many people died, brought it back with an age restriction to mitigate that, and we also find out that the headmasters got hurt at one point in the tournament's history. This tournament sounds like a hazard to me. I don't know about you. But the tournament is getting closer. This chapter ends with Beauxbatons and Durmstrang arriving at Hogwarts. So Beauxbatons comes in a horse-drawn carriage that flies through the air, and Durmstrang comes in a ship that was underneath the water of the lake. So are you ready for a brief history of horse-drawn carriages and ships? I hope so. So the earliest form of a carriage is the chariot in Mesopotamia in 3000 BCE. It had two wheels and was pulled by one or two horses. Carriages throughout history were used for transport of people and items, but also for elegance and fashion. For example, Buckingham Palace has over 100 coaches and carriages that it uses for special occasions like coronations and weddings. So, by the 13th century, chariots went from their two-wheeled form to their four-wheeled form. In the 14th century, passenger coaches began to appear, which had the back wheels were much larger than the front, which helped provide comfort for people who were riding in it, but also allowed it to be pulled by a single horse. Those were originally created in Hungary, and they were in use throughout Western Europe. It's also during this century in England where more luxurious carriages were used to transport wealthy women. By the 16th century, they were general transportation for the upper classes. Also during the 16th century, it was so usual for wealthy people to use them that it was actually seen as lazy if you decided to use a carriage to get around instead of riding a horse. In the 17th century, things continued to evolve for longer distances, more speed, and more style. This is where we see stagecoaches appear in England in 1640. These coaches took passengers much further distances. They were usually pulled by 4 to 6 horses, and they usually held about 9 people, although there were some that existed that held, I believe, up to 12. And they were called stagecoaches because you would do your journey in stages. So you would go a specific distance and then you would stop, you could get out, you would eat, stretch your legs, but also they would replace the horses. So there was less time lost and you could get somewhere more quickly. And at first, these carriages were very uncomfortable to ride in because there were no springs that were used to soften the jolt of the rough roads in England. And then eventually in the 16th century in Paris, we started to see carriages that had glass windows. And those made their way over to England in 1670. But they needed to import the glass from France because this was glass that could handle the ride of a carriage without breaking. Ships and boats, structures that you could take on the water, those date back to 4000 BCE. They've been a very continuous part of society because it allowed movement of all kinds between places. The earliest historic evidence is in Egypt, which had sails and oars, usually a single sail and a row of oarsmen. And then as they eventually ventured out further, extra levels of oarsmen were needed. We mainly saw two types of ships, warships and cargo ships. Warships needed speed and more space for soldiers and fighters, as well as good maneuverability. Cargo ships were more round and needed more space between the deck and the waterline. The design of these ships became more important depending on the need of the ship. So sails were a huge turning point in the history of ships because it replaced the human power of rowing and helped carry heavier loads over longer distances. The Phoenicians had galleys that had both sails and rowing power, and the Vikings would not have had as much success as they did if they did not have ships. So the Viking Age goes from 790 to 1100 CE. They had big cargo ships and long ships that they used for fighting and raiding. And the first depictions of them date between 4000 to 2300 BCE in that region. And sails were introduced to them in the 7th century CE due to contact with Northern Europe, where sails were used a lot. So what do you think, if anything, this shows us or tells us about these two schools, that this is the way that they transport themselves? I do want to point out that Durmstrang, the school that focuses on the dark arts, traveled underwater, which is where the Slytherin Common Room is located. Do we think that has a connection? Perhaps we should do a deep dive on what the symbolism of being underwater means later on. Also, one thought I had was, do wizards use ships when they have things like port keys? You don't really have to cross water if you have a port key, but maybe they used them before they were invented? What does it say about Beauxbatons that they did the exact opposite and flew through the air to get to Hogwarts using a coach with horses? And what does it say about Hogwarts that they use a more modern method of getting to school, a train? We don't really know exactly how Hogwarts would have taken its students to one of these other schools if they were hosting, but it's interesting that we have these two old school methods of transport juxtaposed with a modern one. And one question that relates to a previous episode in Prisoner of Azkaban, this is a little off topic, but we see that the portraits get cleaned. Some of them have been scrubbed. With magic, we're not sure. Just like when the Fat Lady portrait had to be restored, we don't know the magical process of restoring or cleaning portraits or if it takes a special skill or potion. So what do you think about that? What rumors do you think that Sirius has been hearing? Why do you think it was important to mention that Neville was awake during the night too? Let us know at firstyearspodcast@gmail.com or connect with us on Instagram or Twitter at firstyearspod. I'm so curious to hear your thoughts, and I'm excited to jump into the rest of this book with you guys. As always, if you rate and review this podcast and leave your name in Hogwarts House, you'll get a shout out on here as well as earn house points. You can also earn house points every Monday with our Mindful Magic Monday posts on Instagram, as well as our trivia on Wednesdays. For next episode, read chapters 16 through 18, and I will see you guys next time. Sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeyer. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing to make this fandom and this community safe and welcoming.